Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only video game podcast with its very own custom DeLorean. It's July 13th, 2017. Jason and I kick off this episode talking about Final Fantasy XII, which I've played some more of, before moving to two old Rockstar games I've also been replaying, Grand Theft Auto 4 and Red Dead Redemption. After that, it's time for some listener mail. Why are games released when they're released? Would Breath of the Wild have been better with a more present-focused story? What are some other JRPGs like Persona 5? Are single-player games dying? Why would Nintendo make more money from the Switch than the SNES Classic? And should we really trust Nintendo this time around? And lastly, what's our problem with Ready Player One anyway? Stick around. Welcome back to the show. My name is Kirk Hamilton. I am the editor-at-large at Kotaku.com. I am joined this week by Kotaku News editor Jason Schreier from New York. Hello, Jason. Nice to see
Hello,
you.
Hello, Kirk. It's nice of me to join you this week as opposed
yes,
to all the others.
Yes, this week I am joined in an unusual turn of events by Jason Schreier.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Oh, you know, I just try to invite Kotaku staffers on regularly to my personal show that I started and run all by myself. So it was nice of you to join me.
So by the way, you know what's fun now? We have advertisements.
I know. So I was saying this is probably the most 2017 feeling possible that I felt really psyched when I heard a Blue Apron ad on our show, which is not that, like, I don't feel psyched when I look at Kotaku and I see ads on Kotaku, but there's something, I think I just listened to so many podcasts and I actually listened to so many podcasts that have ads for that specific company that when I heard them, it just cracked me up. I was like, we've made it. We're an official podcast now, even though I'm sure some listeners are annoyed.
The funny thing is that we don't actually make any extra money off of this because it's just part of our jobs. So even though it's like it feels like, oh my god, Kirk and Jason are selling out, which I guess we are, we're not actually seeing a dime from any of the ads that are going to be on our show. So
right
take solace in that, dear listeners.
I think that the real sellout happened forever ago when we decided to work for a large company instead of working for ourselves. Isn't that, I mean, I feel like if we ever sold out, that was when it happened.
Sure.
The sellout happened so long
the
ago.
The sellout is when we decided to get jobs and be gainfully employed.
Exactly. Yes. When we decided to join a capitalist society and have jobs, we it was kind of all over then. So this is just one further step along the road toward full selloutville.
Exactly. Anyway, so we will always try to keep our ads, I guess, out of the way or whatever.
Yeah, we don't really have a lot of say over them. So
yeah, that's true. Unless Roomba gives us a call, which we're still waiting to hear back from them. And still, I'm just shocked that nobody at Roomba's marketing team has found out about our show and been like,
You would think the Doritos and the Roomba people would be reaching out, but no word from them yet. At least not that we know of.
Weather.com. Do you want a sponsorship from weather.com?
Yeah. I feel like I don't know. Do you think they would sponsor us?
They could put an article on their homepage that would just be like, you won't believe this podcast. You won't believe what you're getting into with this podcast.
First, he listened to a podcast and then something amazing happened.
But yeah, so we have ads now. Enjoy that. And hopefully it doesn't interfere too much with everyone's enjoyment of Kotaku Split Screen.
I think it'll be fine. It's funny, I've been listening to so many podcasts, mostly political podcasts, over the last 6 months, and some of them have so many ads, and I've just kind of gotten used to it. Uh-huh. To the point where listening to shows with no ads is very nice, but I think I've just sort of adjusted. So hopefully other people have
anyone
as well.
Who listens to podcasts is used to that.
Man, so we're recording this early, so this is going to be something that will be a little bit colder news when everybody's listening to this next week. But did you read this SB Nation thing, this like what football will look like in the future article?
I did not.
Man, okay. Well, what I'm going to say then is maybe by next week it will become the global phenomenon that it deserves to be and everyone will have read it. But if you have not read this thing, you should Google it. It's called, it's basically the year 17,776 and it's
on SB Nation. It's by John Boys, who does the Breaking Bad and stuff.
Right, by John Boys, who is amazing. And it's amazing. It is really, really good. And I don't want to say anything about it other than that, but I read it last night not knowing anything about it, and that's the best way to read it, and was just extremely impressed. And it made me, I don't know, it was a reminder that the internet is an amazing platform for creative writers and something that I don't think I take advantage of enough in my own work, and that we all could. You know, it's just the sky is the limit, really. You can just have a really wild, interesting idea and do something so fascinating using, you know, all of the sort of multimedia tools the internet has available to you. It doesn't just have to be paragraphs and sentences. And it's really good. I thought it was very, very neat and funny and weird and fun to read. So hopefully everybody checks that out.
Well, I will check it out for sure.
Well, are we going to talk about games? You want to talk about some video games?
Yeah, and then we will jump into questions and answers. Or maybe we should just read questions and skip all the answers.
Just questions. It's a really open, it's a sort of a like a philosophically weird podcast. We're just asking questions.
Look,
we're just
asking questions. Respond to them with questions. Yeah.
So you want to, maybe we could talk about Final Fantasy XII a little bit more. I know we talked about that.
Yeah, so have you played more of that?
I did. So I played a little bit more of it. I'm currently under the castle, I guess. Like I snuck into this big event that was happening, the Fate, as Vaughn keeps calling it, and sort of went undercover as one of the servants and was kind of there to rob them, and then stole this thing and ran into some sky pirates. And
met Balthier.
Yes, I met Balthier and a hot a rabbit lady in a like basically in a Playboy Bunny outfit.
Balthier and a hot rabbit lady, yeah.
And well. Yeah, and then we fought some underground. Like I have a party now, and I can assign gambits.
Mm-hmm.
And what? I killed a bunch of rats, a bunch of dire rats, and then met what's her name, whose name began with an A. And when you meet her, she's like the Princess Leia or whatever. Amalia, yes. And the amazing sequence when you meet her and she's fighting guys up on this ledge and she looks down and Vaughn's like, jump! And then she jumps in slow motion and it's this really dreamy slow-mo shot and then he catches her and it's just not romantic at all. I didn't think, or at least it was really goofy looking. And,
yeah, I don't think, well, okay, I won't say any, I don't want to spoil the plot for you, but I don't know if it's supposed to, I think it's supposed to be goofy looking.
Well, I was assuming that because I know there are Star Wars parallels that she's going to turn out to be his sister. But yeah, so that scene was just kind of awkward. The game so far is this awkward mix of, it mostly looks modern, or parts of it look modern. It actually looks a lot like Final Fantasy XIV, I think.
Huh.
Except that some of the animations and some of the stylings, the way the sort of blurry zoom thing that Final Fantasy games do, it just feels very PS2 era, even though it's modern. But
I have a few questions for you.
Yes, go ahead.
First of all, have you used the fast forward button at all?
I already started using it because
I
was
that useful.
Yeah, I mean it just, I was already noticing going through the first dungeon, through the sewers underneath the castle. I was like, okay, so I'm just gonna fight 10 rats and it's just going to be stupid and it's going to be the same fight every time. So then I was like, I wonder how this fast forward works, and kind of turned it on, and it just felt like it was a more reasonable pace in general. So yeah, uh-huh. I've been using it for that, though not for exploring or anything.
Okay,
like
second question. Have you been using the gambits? Have you set some for yourself?
I have. So they remind me of Dragon Age has a similar system.
Yes.
And you know, I think that there are definitely other CRPGs that have sort of similar stuff. So, I just
taken from Final Fantasy. I mean, Final Fantasy XII came out before Dragon Age,
right? But I wonder, there was nothing like this in Baldur's Gate or Baldur's Gate 2?
Baldur's Gate had contingency spells that you could use that would activate on contingency, but they weren't quite the same. I didn't have complicated AI the way.
I would be very surprised if Final Fantasy XII was really the first game to have a system like this, but. Regardless, I've been using it, and
it does it more elegantly, I would say, than other games do.
I think it's, so far it seems well put together. There's a little bit of It's a little confusing just in terms of line of sight and targeting, but I'm not really fighting enemy arrangements of enemies yet that, you know, sort of would require me to do complicated tanking where I'm drawing aggro from a boss and there's adds and stuff. So far, I don't really know yet how that's all going to play out. But
yeah, well, so the unfortunate thing is there actually is no aggro system. So there's no way to make sure that one person tanks other than just having them be the first person to attack. So you can set a party leader, but there's no way to just prevent other people from getting attacked.
I think I might not have unlocked that yet or something. So I can set it so that Balthier is my party leader and he kind of is running in first and I'm controlling
him. So you have unlocked, at any point you can switch your party leaders. And so you can just press the down key, the down button on the directional pad to switch party leaders.
And then I take control of the
you can take control of
Okay.
You can also pause at any time and like issue commands in the middle of battles. So what you can do, and so let me give you an idea of like what my gambit setup is like. So I have one character who's the tank, and I'll have them, I have a gambit on them for them to automatically attack whichever enemy has the lowest health. So that way they'll be focusing killing people first. And then I have the other guys in the party all set up to attack whoever the party leader is attacking. So they won't just go off on their own and do their own thing. They'll just be focused. And then I also have some other interesting gambits. So here's a pro tip. So Vaughn, and I think Balthier also, come with the steal ability. And so what you can do, there's no gambit for like this enemy has an item that you can steal or anything like that. So the trick is to have it set up so the first thing they do is when you see an enemy at 100% health, you steal from them. So that way, you start fighting them, he won't keep trying to steal over and over again. He'll only do it the first time you see them. So there are other like clever ways you can manipulate the system. And as you'll see, you can go to the shop a little bit later and buy more gambit, which are more conditions that you can purchase. And
yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Really in-depth, really granular stuff.
Yeah, I went into the Gambit shop just when I was exploring the town and was like, oh, okay, so I'm going to buy AI routines for my party, basically, which is sort of cool. Yeah, it's interesting. The game is very interesting. I can definitely see why it was controversial and why the combat system, you know, was just sort of frowned upon or not loved by Final Fantasy fans, even though, I would think you would really have to get into the gambit system for it to feel rewarding. Because if you just play with manual control of everything, like telling them what to do, it really feels kind of weird. It feels like disconnected in that MMO-ish way where you just walk up to something and your guy just starts swinging. There isn't that sort of press a button and something happens thing.
That's the thing that really takes getting used to is the auto attack. And at first you're like, man, I wish I would just be pressing the attack and doing it manually instead of watching it. But the more you play and once you start creating, like the cool thing about it is you can transform your party into this death machine. Especially once you start playing around more with the jobs. Have you picked jobs for any of your party yet?
Yeah, I did. I just looked up sort of the recommended jobs because I was like, I do not have time or interest to figure this out. So Vaughn is a monk. Rabbit Lady is a white mage. Balthier is a, it means with a U. It's like a spear fighter.
Ulan. So the funny thing is, even though you're looking it up, those people actually don't know because this is the first incarnation of the game where you can have each character use two jobs rather than just one. So a little bit later you unlock the second job.
These Final Fantasy leveling systems are fucking nonsense. I mean, I'm not a fan of the way that each Final Fantasy game just makes leveling into this extremely elaborate and opaque visual graphic, like conceptual clusterfuck. Like, I just don't like it. I don't like the big crystal like maze in FF13. I don't like the radial nonsense in FF10. It's just so elaborate and needlessly elaborate. And I always feel like I'm committing to shit that I can't undo. It does bug me. And so I wind up looking it up and that's fine. But it also just doesn't explain itself very well. Like, there is just not, I know that RPGs in general struggle with this kind of stuff, like with user interface and leveling and making all their menus approachable. But Final Fantasy really, I think, suffers for it when you just look at it as, is this game approachable or accessible?
Interesting. See, I disagree with you on that. I agree with you that it's not explained well, but I disagree on your enjoyment of this. Or I guess I feel differently because I very much enjoy the customization and the sphere grid of 12 of 10 and then the license boards of 12. I really enjoy
it. Yeah, I think I'm guessing part of that is just that I'm coming to it so much later and having, you know, just a different perspective. And if you kind of grew up,
or maybe
and just
once
them,
you play more and get the hang of it, you'll.
Yeah. And I do appreciate something about JRPGs in general and Final Fantasy in that you kind of level along a set track. Like you don't exactly, you can pick, you know, at various juncture points or you can pick to focus on certain things, but there isn't a lot of that really specific customization that you do once you pick your job anyways.
Right.
Which I actually sort of like, just that it takes that off your plate. Like I like how in Fire Emblem games, your characters just level up, you know? Mm-hmm. There are choices that you make, but the smaller granular stuff you don't really worry about. I actually don't mind that.
So,
I don't...
yeah, and then another thing that will help you make decisions is that you can actually just save up your license points, and then the next time you get to a shop and you look through the weapons and stuff, you just say, oh, hey, I want to get this weapon, so I'm going to go to that character and figure out the way to unlock that license for that weapon. And to do it that way makes it a little simpler.
I get the sense that these early abilities that I'm buying are so cheap that it's just not really a big deal. Like it's not, I'm not yet wasting stuff. So I've, at this point, I'm just sort of assuming, okay, I can do whatever.
The other thing is that you'll get a lot of license points, especially because of the fast forward option now. You can just keep going through and killing enemies really quickly.
Yeah, I feel like this will be a good one to play on Vita. I wonder how far I'll get in it. I mean, I really like the music. The music is so good that it makes me like the game more than I think I would otherwise, because the music is really, really good. Undertown?
Hold on. I don't think that's a fair thing to say. I feel like the music is just as much a valid part of the game as anything else. I mean,
but it is a part of the game that I could just very easily lift out and replace with a more generic soundtrack and then think, would I like this game nearly as much? And
sure, but you could say the same thing about Undertale. And that definitely wouldn't be nearly as good without the music.
But I mean, there are a lot of things about Undertale that I would like, and that could well be true of FF12 as well. It's just when I immediately just am playing this game and in the moment, nothing is doing very much for me except for the music. Like I'm not really that drawn in by the story yet. The characters aren't great. Like I wish the main character just wasn't this like little pretty boy shithead. Like I really do. He really bothers me and his stupid pants. And so, you know, I haven't met.
Don't worry.
Yeah. I'm sure there are good characters, and I can tell like some of the voice acting is very, very good. I like the actor who's playing the guy who's sort of in charge of everything, the guy you do errands for at the beginning. He's like a sort of a monster. I don't know what kind of creature he is. He looks like a Snuffleupagus sort of.
Yeah. You know who that is?
Who is it? It's someone famous.
John DiMaggio.
Okay, that's okay. That tracks. I was like, I know this voice. This is somebody.
It's funny. The voice acting is all incredible. From Balthier is great. Fran has a great voice. Amalia, she has a good voice. All the voices are good except for Vaughn, who just has the worst.
I looked him up.
He hasn't done anything since.
And some of the ways that they're recorded are kind of jarring. Like Vaughn, it really sounds like a little kid talking into a tape recorder in a bathroom, which just sort of detracts. But really, Vaughn's character design is what I don't like. It's just this really stupid, like, though kids will think this is cool, like this is what gamers want kind of a character design. And Titus was similar, like where it's just like, oh, he's like sporty.
No, Titus
but cool.
is more of a character. He's
but
more
his
of
character
a real...
design. I mean, specifically his character design, not the way he's written. Like just the fact that he's like wearing overalls with like a weird blue patch on the leg and like has his like, you know, he's kind of buff, but looks like a little kid and his like pretty face and his cool spiky blonde hair. I'm just like, dude, I wish you looked more like an interesting guy, like, and not this kid. So that sort of bums me out. And then just the overall aesthetic, it looks kind of like FF14. But it's not, it hasn't like, that hasn't grabbed me. But when I'm playing it, the music is amazing. And it gives things so much character that I really do just right now. I'm like just playing because I want to hear more music, which to the game's credit, it's very, very good music.
Yeah, it's funny. The fast forward thing, which I love to death, like makes the game for me. If that So if you were playing the game on an emulator, any game on an emulator, it would also fast forward the music. But because this is actually built into the game, it doesn't fast forward the music. So it makes the game still pleasant to play. And you don't have to listen to like high speed like tracks.
Like sped up like chipmunk speed orchestral tracks. I also noticed that there are a ton of, you know, this, you can tell that this was a PS2 game only because there are so many loading areas. Like the areas are so small when you're out in the world exploring compared to FF14. But because the segues are actually handled really well, I think. Like, I feel like the loading times so far haven't been a huge problem, and that makes the game flow a lot better for me. So that I like. I like that it has felt pretty contiguous, even though it's clearly, you know, had to be broken up at the time to run on the PS2.
Yeah, I think you'll play more just because it's July and there isn't a lot of other stuff to play. It's like this and then the Destiny 2 beta.
There are some other games that that I've been playing that I have.
What else are you working on?
So I've been replaying two big Rockstar games, and I've been playing these for a little while, but we haven't had a chance to talk about them on the show. But I played the beginning of Grand Theft Auto 4 and also the beginning of Red Dead Redemption. And both are really interesting games, man. Both are really interesting games. When was the last time you played either of those?
You're playing both on PC?
No, GTA 4 on PC and Red Dead Redemption on Xbox One, Xbox 360.
Oh, yeah, Red Dead isn't on PC. Yeah. So, I played both of them when they came out and haven't played them since.
Oh, wow. I was in a period where I replayed GTA 4 a lot. I got really into sort of... That was one of the first games where I got really into turning off the minimap and doing... I had a game I would play and I tried this.
The patented Kirk Hamilton.
That was where it began. That was one of the first articles I wrote for Kotaku was... the headline was this really asshole headline. It was, "You're playing GTA 4 wrong." And it was all about the minimap and like the specific way that I play. But that was sort of like the thesis statement for the thing that has now become...
Was that really the headline of your article?
Yeah. Jeez. This was like when we were a little more dickish. Like that was like the slightly more aggressive Joel Johnson era of Kotaku.
I bet nowadays, if you wrote a headline like that, it would get like smarmy tweets about, "Oh, Kotaku, don't tell me how to play video games."
Yeah, oh, yeah. Definitely. Definitely. And I mean, I actually think that headlines, any headline that's about you, that's like telling you you're doing, like even the headlines are like, "You need to see this." Do I really need to see this? Don't fucking tell me what I need to do. So I play that game with the minimap turned off. I think with the HUD turned off in general, with the camera zoomed all the way in, which you can do in GTA 4 and you can't do in GTA 5. Mm-hmm. But I mean, GTA 5 has first person now, I guess. But in 4, you can zoom the camera way in so it's right on Nico's shoulder. So it gets you kind of right in there with him. And with no HUD, and then I would just kind of walk around. And the game I would play is, and I did this when I was replaying as well, I'll like get just a pistol and then I'll sort of shoot near a cop, not at a cop, but near a cop. And then he'll start chasing me, but he won't. I think if I don't shoot, he won't shoot at me. And then I just start running. And then the game is just, how far can I run from the cops without them catching me?
You realize how deranged this sounds, right?
Well, I mean, video games. But it is really fun. The game is really well designed. It kind of... There's a few things about GTA 4 that I noticed the farther I push it that I think are really interesting. One is that the alleyways in that game are very well made. It's almost impossible, especially on the east side of the map, like in Broker, to run into an alleyway and hit a dead end. Huh. So if you're running from the cops, there's never a dead end, which I'm sure was designed on purpose so that you can always have an escape avenue. So you'll run in and then you'll find a little thing and you'll hook left and then you'll come out in a new neighborhood and you're like running. And you know, if you really get the cops on you, like if you shoot a cop or something, then your stars go way up. And then you've got a helicopter chasing you. And it has this very like sort of hard-boiled, not realistic exactly, but like more hard-boiled and kind of down-to-earth vibe to it than anything in GTA 5. And I really like that about it.
I remember the shooting mechanics being kind of feeling clunky in both that and 5, really.
Yeah, 5 is definitely better and has gotten better over time as they've sort of updated it and patched it. First-person mode definitely helped. 4's shooting is definitely not... It feels like the first time they put real shooting into a GTA 4 or into a GTA game. Uh-huh. Just because if you've played San Andreas recently, like that game is old school Vice City style. There's
I
no
never
cover.
Played San Andreas. I've told
really?
You this,
oh,
right?
That
yeah,
game.
I've
is...
never played 3 or San Andreas or.
Oh wow.
4 was my first GTA.
Yeah, San Andreas was the first one that I owned, because I think I got it for Xbox 360 when I got back into video games in like 2007 and played it. It's really impressive, but also really rough in some ways. Like, there's no cover mechanic, and there's the checkpoints are just garbage. Like, you'll get kicked back to the beginning of a map or of an entire mission if you die at the end.
Sounds where like Watch 4 Dogs kind of, too.
Well, it's worse even. Like, 4, like, at least introduced mid-mission checkpoints sometimes, and, like, it started to get more player-friendly. And
yeah,
then
4 could be frustrating about that, too, from what I remember.
Yeah, it still has like vestigial like elements of the earlier games. Though it also it's also interesting, like the cop AI, this has actually been documented by people on YouTube and stuff, but the AI for the police officers in GTA 4 is more sophisticated than in GTA 5. There are things that they have more stages of alert. Like there's a whole thing when you sort of do something violent, but not, you don't shoot at a cop or kill anyone, the cops will take their guns out and they'll like approach you and they'll be like, get down on the ground, you're under arrest, but they don't shoot at you immediately. And there are a couple other sort of stages like that don't exist in GTA 5, where in GTA 5, they're just like, we're coming to get you, like you're getting shot and we're just going to kill you. And
I wonder why they simplify that.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, it could have been just like a memory requirement thing, since GTA 5 is so much more ambitious in so many other ways that they just didn't have the bandwidth, or they didn't think it was as fun. They wanted to simplify car chases. I'm not sure.
How does it look compared to, like, how does it feel like that? Have the aesthetics aged well?
I think so. I'm playing on PC, and the PC version has some real problems. It's just, I think that Rockstar should be a little embarrassed about the PC version, because it's kind of the one like current way to play the game, and it's a really good game. I really love GTA 4. I think it's a very good and daring and interesting game, and it just sucks that the PC version, it crashes for me a lot. There's no good way for me to quit it. Like, just I have to like restart my computer to get out of it, so that sort of sucks. But it looks great. I think at the time people were like, oh, it's all brown, because it's very brown and orange, especially at the beginning. But I think that it has an aesthetic. Like, I think that it does sort of have a consistent aesthetic from start to finish that I actually don't think GTA 5 has. And it's striking.
I mean, living in New York, I loved the aesthetic. So
yeah, like it feels like you're in New York, and there is like an art, like there's an art vision behind the game. And like Nico is a great character, and I think that the animations are still really good. It's still remarkable how Rockstar is just sort of out in front of everybody, and or at least was at the time, just with expressive character, you know, animations and cutscenes and stuff.
So how about Red Dead? How is that these
that
days?
That game is really impressive.
It's aged really well.
Yeah, it's aged really, really well. That game looks awesome still. I wish that game would come out on PC. I know I'm the only person to ever say that's true, but yeah. And I don't have
even PS4 would be nice.
I mean, yeah, oh yeah, definitely. Like, well, PC and current gen would be awesome. I mean, so I, you know, obviously
there
I don't
need
to.
It must be the rumors about them losing the code or being unable to port the game or whatever. There must be some truth to that, because that seems like such an obvious move to release it on next gen and current gen consoles in preparation for Red Dead 2 next year.
And it could still happen. I mean, they have so much money and manpower. But I assume that the stories of that game's code just being kind of a mess and being really hard to hold together, and then like that would just means that it would require a lot more work and therefore a lot more money to get it ported. But yeah, I would think they would sell so many copies that it'd be worth it.
They really would. And it would be such a perfect lead into the second one. Like, remind everybody that they made this masterpiece.
So really briefly on that game, just because I haven't played as much of it, I play that game also with no minimap, which makes it harder. You have to really navigate by the sun and stuff. But that game is really, both that and GTA 4 are so striking because they begin so slowly. The slow burn at the whole beginning of Red Dead Redemption is fascinating. This whole sequence on the train where you're kind of listening to, you're overhearing these conversations between, it's like this lady, like a preacher and his daughter, these two white people talking about like the savages who are being tamed in this land that they're claiming and taking over. And it's just all very, very low key. And like, it's foreshadowing stuff, but doing it in a pretty subtle way, for the most part, at least in terms of his story. And then him just sort of arriving, and he meets this guy and he rides out to find Bill at the fort. The whole thing is really, really
good.
Don't
you have to go wrangle sheep? Or no, that's after you.
Oh, that's way later. Like, the beginning is just, Your dude, John Marston, arrives in town.
Right, you have to do the shootout, and then you get capped. And
there isn't even a shootout. Like he literally just arrives in town. He goes and meets a guy that he's arranged to meet at a saloon. They get on horses and they ride. The guy takes him out to where Bill is at this fort.
Uh-huh.
And then John is just like calls out to Bill, and he's like, "Bill, I'm here." And it's actually, I don't know, even I just have a different take on it now, I think, than I did the first time I played it. It's a really cool scene. He's kind of saying like, "All right, man, I'm here. Like I'm, you know, what's behind me? Like the world is coming. Like the future is coming. Mm-hmm. The Federales are gonna come, or whatever. The FBI, these guys who hired me are behind me. There's a whole army. They're gonna come kill you. But they sent me first, and I'm here to just kind of warn you and say, look, do you like want to come peacefully or not?" And Bill, of course, doesn't. And he shoots him in the side and is like, "All right, you're dead. Fuck off." Mm-hmm. And then that kind of sets in motion the entire story, really, and like establishes the sort of themes and the characters and the central conflict. And I know there are parts of this game that fall apart. I don't know if I'll play the whole thing. Like the whole part in Mexico, I remember being just sort of this pointless digression there.
Yeah.
But the beginning is really good, and just
although the moment you discover Mexico is pretty memorable.
Yes, yeah, it's more just you get involved in that whole Mexican Civil War,
right.
And it's just
and
like,
it
what
feels
the fuck
like
am I doing?
Too much. Yeah.
And but yeah, I really, it's a really cool game. So it's
I was listening
really cool
to someone. I'm trying to remember. I was listening to some podcast where they talk about games, and they were talking about how they basically wished that Red Dead kind of had the courage to, instead of just having the one driving goal that you have to go find Bill Williamson, to let you take care of that earlier and then have other things pop up. And
yeah,
they're talking about narratively how it doesn't really work because it feels like it's going on for way too long.
Well, it's interesting because there is a point at which you finally kill Bill, and it does kind of blow that moment. And sort of, it keeps going. Remember, there's sort of this
other guy. Well, you
have to
go find Dutch.
Yeah, Dutch becomes a thing. So it sort of loses the thread, and then it refines it again. And I think, you know, I think this game has one of the great final acts and the great endings of in video games. And yeah, there's a sense that they kind of put too much in it, and they didn't totally focus things. Maybe I will play it. I don't remember it well enough, some of the specifics, to get into it. But I think
I don't think it's that long. I think you can pretty much crank through the main story in 15-20 hours if you don't do side quests.
Yeah, which would require me to focus on that and not FF12 and whatever else.
That's
but
true.
Yeah, I think it would
no,
be cool
play
to
FF12
do.
Instead.
I don't know. So many good games. So many games I want to play.
Yeah. So we should get to some questions, by the way. Did you have any final thoughts before we jump into the questions?
No, that's pretty much it. They're both really cool games and worth replaying.
So
if
that's
you're
three.
Able.
The three games we just talked about are all old games.
Yeah, old games.
The
old
summer.
Games week.
You can tell it's summer.
Yep.
Time
definitely.
To talk about old games. All right, let's get into some reader Q&A.
Let's do them.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And we're the hosts of Lifehacker's podcast, The Upgrade. On The Upgrade, we help you improve your life one week at a time. We talk to guests like former hacker Hector Monsegur about online security.
You need to be aware of how you could be attacked. You need to be aware of what's your weakness.
And Alan Alda on how to communicate more effectively.
And in order to achieve that, we start with teaching exercises derived from improvisation.
And sex therapist Steven Snyder about how to have great sex in a long-term relationship.
What really works under those circumstances is if you enjoy the other person selfishly.
Hey, your life? It's terrible. We can help.
Find The Upgrade wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So first of all, as always, you can reach us at splitscreen@kotaku.com with any questions. Kirk and I go through all of them. We don't read all of them on the show, but we do read all of them. And sorry in advance if we didn't pick yours and if we didn't respond to yours, we get a lot of these things. But keep sending them in. They're awesome. We love hearing from you guys. So
yes,
we're just going to jump through a bunch that I've been saving over the past few months. First of all, Greg says, Jason, just read your Mass Effect Andromeda article. Really great job. I pre-ordered your book as soon as I finished it. Can't wait. You can see, by the way, Kirk, why I read why I'm
And that's the
book.
End of the letter. That's all he wrote. It. Next one.
Jason, end of the
I love,
show,
I
actually.
Can't wait to read your book. I'm so
okay,
excited.
Okay, so Greg says, quick question for you guys. I've never played a JRPG before, but I got Persona 5 based on your and Kirk recommendation. I absolutely love it. Makes me feel stoned before I actually get stoned. As a newbie to the genre, what should I play next that's similarly bonkers? Also, as a fellow New Yorker planning a wedding here, I feel your pain. Pricey stuff. Best of luck. I appreciate that.
So you're going to be probably better equipped to answer this one than me, but okay. I have some thoughts, but I'm curious what you recommend.
Well, so, I mean, Greg saying that he wants to feel stoned makes me immediately think of Earthbound, which is pretty much an acid trip disguised as a JRPG.
Mm-hmm.
Persona 5 is, incredible, obviously. Similar game. I mean, there aren't a lot of JRPGs that are similar to that.
So one thing I would say to Greg is that any of the Shin Megami Tensei games, like Devil Summoner Overclocked is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Like, there are other games. And obviously Persona 4, I think, goes without saying that Persona 4 or Persona 4 Golden, if you have a Vita, those are cool. And like, if you
Although
like
that's
that,
going to be hard to play after Persona 5, because Persona 5 has so many quality of life improvements.
I guess so, but I think it's doable. Like, it's still good. It just, there's a couple things you have to get used to. But I, you know, if you like that sort of modern day Japan, like The World Ends With You is another one that's set with like teens in modern day Japan.
Catherine is a good one. Different genre.
That is
still same style, and it's just as trippy.
Yeah, made by the same team. Catherine's actually a really cool game. It's not like Persona in that you're not doing turn-based battles. It's more of a like action puzzle game, but with that sort of social sim. It's a weird game. It's really good. Actually, that's a good recommendation, I bet.
Yeah, Catherine.
If you finish Persona 5 and want something that's a little different but made by the same people,
and then
Catherine
the other
is
thing
a really
is,
cool game.
Is Trails of Cold Steel, which is not not similar stylistically, and it's not it's not modern day. It's very fantasy medieval, but it has the school setting and social links and stuff like that. So it's Persona-ish, and those games are pretty great. Slow, but very slow, but pretty great. And nice. I guess if you liked Persona 5, you don't mind a little bit slow,
right?
All right.
But those are solid recommendations, though, for Greg.
You want to do the next one?
Yes. Okay. So this is Liam.
Oh, wait. Liam. Hold on. So this is going to be a little bit spoily for Zelda Breath of the Wild. Not super spoily. I'm just skimming this over. No, it's not super spoily. Just mild spoilers for Breath of the Wild.
Yeah. There's kind of a mild spoilers and an explanation of just the premise of the game. So Liam writes, I wanted to know how you guys felt about the story choices in Breath of the Wild, where it's set 100 years after this great climactic event, filled with these fantastic characters that I just want to live with in a world clearly bustling with life. After I did the first dungeon, I got super disappointed because I wanted to spend my whole game with Mipha. yet the only interaction with her was through these quick cutscenes and what everyone else thought of her. It kind of affected my playthrough negatively. So do you guys think this was a smart choice? Maybe they wanted to leave the player detached from the story enough that they can really enjoy the world without this big story hanging over them? Or do you think that this already amazing game could have benefited from a different time setting, possibly forgetting the 100-year time skip and Link gets to train and interact with these characters and in those towns? Because as I wander around this huge world, I can't help but feel that I, the player, am just on the outside of this cool party that I wish I could go to. What do you think of that, Jason?
Well, I think that, I mean, I disagree. I love the way that it was presented. And I also think that they've been hinting that the second DLC pack, which comes out this fall, is going to be set in the 100 years ago time. Mm. So maybe we will actually get to interact with those characters and experience their story. I mean, I can totally see why someone would be disappointed that you don't actually get to have present day interactions with these characters, other than a couple of seeing their ghosts a few times. But I love the way it was presented. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, I think the whole it's so fundamental to the game's vibe and the way that it's telling its story and the world that they've created. I mean, I feel like this game more than I think I would safely say any game I've ever played, like, nails that feeling of this grand kingdom that has fallen into ruin and it was once beautiful and now there's just like this kind of this civilization living in the ruins of it. And everywhere you go, there's this feeling that like grand epic things happened here and now they're over. And like Zelda has kind of always had that feeling, like that feeling of like a lost kingdom and whatever. And this to me felt like just this super distilled version of that. And I loved that. I mean, I don't know. I wrote about the music, the way that when you ride your horse, sometimes there's these plinky piano and then out of it, the sort of Zelda theme, the famous music just sort of floats up at you and then it floats away just as quickly. Like, I think that's so beautiful and so perfect for sort of what the game is doing that I wouldn't want it any other way, even though I'm sure it could have been cool the other way. Like, I loved that specific vibe so much that I wouldn't want it to be different.
It's also a really cool way, a really smart way of telling a story in an open world game is to deliver it through these memories that you can see in any order.
I mean, and it really is like playing to the limitations of the technology right now. I mean, if you compare this to, Skyrim, where in Skyrim, you're going around and you're talking to people who are actually there and you're engaged in a story that's taking place in real time. And in those games, there's always those disappointing moments where the big epic battle happens and you stop for a second and look and it's just like 20 people at most fighting 10 monsters in a just sort of shitty fight, and it just doesn't look like you would picture it. Where in this, it's much more, you know, they managed to fit everything and have it all fit together better without ever having to break the illusion in that way.
Yeah.
Which is just smart. I think that's just smart development, like using the limitations or leaning into the limitations in a smart way.
It's also, and it's also they don't have to worry about how the story, the ongoing story, will impact the world the way that a game like Skyrim does and kind of fails to do, because Skyrim fails to make you feel like the Civil War is actually having an impact on the cities you're visiting. The only thing that changes is what the guards say when you walk by them.
It's that open world pacing issue where if it's happening in real time and you want to fuck off and do side quests for 20 hours, it starts to feel weird. And that tension does exist in Breath of the Wild. Like, there is that feeling of, man, Zelda is really holding it down for me in Hyrule Castle right now, and I'm off just collecting Korok seeds forever. But it's way less pressing because of the way the story is presented. Most of everything has already happened. It does work for the game's pacing.
All right. Chris says, hey, Jason and Kirk, big fan of the podcast and site. I was wondering, is there any logic and reasoning behind when video games are released, like with movies? I understand the holiday season usually sees a spike, which makes sense. But what about releasing something like Splatoon in late July and having very few releases in August? Does the release date really have a large effect on sales figures? And how much does this weigh into when studios release games? I don't know. I don't have any like specific data on this, but I believe that a lot of developers have said that summer tends to be slower for selling games, or at least traditionally that is. I think there are different rules when it comes to AAA and indie. I think there are, it depends on the year. It depends on a lot of different factors. For Splatoon 2 specifically, I think Nintendo's goal was to make this like the summer of local competitive multiplayer stuff on the Switch. So it's ARMS and Splatoon 2 and a couple other games that are split-screen friendly. or like co-op friendly or whatever. And then their goal was to release a game every month, I think that it is. So like August, they have Mario Rabbids. I think that's their big game for August. And July, yeah, is Splatoon.
I think that some of this is going to be different depending on who's releasing the game, right? I mean, so we see a lot of companies release games in October and November, and I think that's seems like the games sell well then. People buy them for gifts. It's that is the general thinking there. But, you know, right, like you're saying, so Nintendo wants to have one big game come out every month this year, which I think they're going to do. And Nintendo's goal isn't just to release games and sell them. It's also to give people reasons to buy a Switch. Mm-hmm. So they have a whole strategy around that. So you're going to see slightly different releases from Nintendo than you would see from somebody else. I mean, we still get Mario coming out in October. So they're still doing their other big tentpole game is coming out in October. But, like, you know, they kind of staggered things out. So there's partly that. And, like, Sony, I think, does the same thing. Like, Sony kind of, it seems like they have a plan for a lot of their games, even though, like, Sony seems like they have left the last several falls pretty dry.
I think
for PS4 games.
Well, so two things. First of all, the logic and reasoning to answer Chris's first question is a lot of that is based around financial quarters. So every company, every publicly traded company has four quarters in the year. And at the end of that quarter, they have to report all their finances for that quarter and how well they did and talk to investors and yada, yada, yada. And so oftentimes you'll see games released in March because that is when a quarter ends. And so they want to fit that game's release and the sales, the day one sales, into that quarter while giving the game as much time as possible in development. The second thing I think with Sony, I think Sony has gotten a lot of kind of flack over the years for just delaying their games constantly. But I think they're also very good at giving their studios enough time, like as much time as necessary to make these games, which is why we see stuff like Horizon taking 5 years and The Last Guardian taking 400 years. So with Sony, I think we're just seeing them putting out games when they're ready, no matter when that happens to be. So you might have a big cluster of games in one quarter of the year and then a giant gap.
And like the calculus for Sony or Nintendo is going to be different than the calculus for an EA or an Activision, because Sony and Nintendo are also trying to sell hardware.
Yes.
And Activision and EA aren't. Like, I know, like, Activision, I believe, just does not delay games at all. They just hit. Like, when an Activision game has a release date announced, it's coming out that day. I'm sure they've delayed games in the past, but it seems like they almost never do. But they just have a different...
Destiny 2?
But they didn't announce a release date for that.
That's true.
But yeah, I think once you get a date for an Activision game, it's very, very unlikely that they'll do the thing where, like, a month before, when everyone's waiting for it, you know, then Jason Schreier reports on Kotaku that the game is going to be delayed.
Yeah, well, Activision is, I mean, they only release like two games a year anyway, and one of them is Call of Duty. So Blizzard, on the other hand, they release games whenever they're ready.
Right. And so, you know, and then Blizzard's another good example. Like, they have their own motivations for it. And so there's going to be a difference between software and hardware, I think, that you'll see. But yeah, I mean, I think the main thinking is, when is this game going to do the best and have the biggest impact? Whatever that means, whether that means selling a lot or doing really well and selling and getting people to want to buy our console, like whatever that means. That's generally what, you know, these companies think when they're figuring out when to sell stuff.
All right, you want to do the next one?
Okay, here we go. Next one is from Andrew. Andrew writes, I am as big a book nerd as I am a video game nerd, so listening to you guys discuss books is awesome for me. This was after a couple weeks ago when we talked about books on the show. Could you please talk more about why you didn't like Ready Player One? I liked the book a lot. Sure, it wasn't one of the best things I've ever read, but I had a lot of fun reading it. What are your thoughts? Also, what are the next few books on your reading lists? What are you looking forward to? So let's start with Ready Player One. We got a few messages after you and I both mentioned not really loving that book from people saying, a couple of people saying, oh, please tear the book apart, and a couple people saying, wait, I don't get why you don't like it. I liked it. Go ahead. I'm curious what are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, so first of all, the next book on my reading list is World War Z, thanks to you. So
yes.
I bought that and I'm going to read it.
That's very exciting.
I just started it. And so as for Ready Player One, I read it a while ago, so I don't really remember it that well. I don't think I hated it. I think I thought it was just fine and kind of flat for me. It didn't really do it for me. I think the biggest problem for me was that it was just nonstop 80s references, and it wasn't my era that I grew up in. Like, I was a little bit later than that, so a lot of the references were just didn't do it for me, and it just felt like it was trying too hard to shove them in my face, and it just mm-hmm. wasn't doing it for me. What about you?
I thought it was a fun book. Like, I think if you just kind of read it as a fun book and don't think about it, you can totally enjoy yourself. But the mm-hmm. more I thought about it, the more I just, there are things about it that bugged me. So the 80s thing, it was not really my cup of tea either. That's closer, you know, I'm older than you, so that's closer to my generation, but still isn't quite. Like, I didn't quite grow up with E.T. and those old, you know, Commodore and Atari games the way that Ernest Cline clearly did. And I thought that the authorship of the world was so clearly defined by this one worldview, which is basically, I think at the time that it was published, a guy who's in his late 30s, you know, and grew up in suburban America, and it's like this one view. And then the story itself is basically about a new world that has been defined by that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And it never really got into that or like explored what that means. It was like this kind of terrifying dystopia for anyone who isn't that guy, like who doesn't think that E.T. is the best movie of all time and that like the original adventure was like this great thing and is like so into that entire just aesthetic. So it's almost like a dystopian book that doesn't realize it's dystopian. Like, there's an obvious dystopia where, you know, the world itself is a dystopia. You don't really ever get to see it, but it is. But also, like, the whatever it's called, the operating system that they all go into is its own sort of dystopia. It's this weird world where everyone is just totally obsessed with the 80s all the time. And it's never looked at as, like, a bad thing or even critically by the book. And I think that was my overall problem. The book plays with this. It faints at it, especially toward the end. There's this scene, and I'm going to spoil the end of the book, so skip forward a few minutes. There's a scene at the end of the book where the guy, the like last remaining dude, his partner or whatever, he uh-huh. shows the main character this button. And he's like, this button, he's like, welcome, like here's the keys to the castle, to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, you can do anything. Then there's also this button, and this button would delete the entire thing. And, you know, maybe you want to know that's there. Okay, anyways. And then it ends. And I thought that idea, like the idea that this thing that he had created was actually bad and that it was causing the entire world to kind of like avoid the problems of the world and just live in this fantasy world created by this one dude and be obsessed with Back to the Future and drive around in DeLoreans and whatever. Like, the fact that maybe is a bad thing, I think, is interesting. And I don't know that the book would have been more enjoyable if it had gone really hard in that direction and become really like self-critical. Like, it was a fun, breezy read, and I don't think it would have worked. But it did kind of bug me in the end. I was like, well, this
that
is
it
just...
It bugged you that it was unexplored.
Yeah, that it was unexplored, and it was just such, like, fucking fan service. The whole book is just so like ultimate nerd dream come true. Like, he just, you know, there's all these scenes where he's just like the ultimate badass, I know everything and I win everything and I get the girl, and like it just that aspect to it, like the sort of just blatant wish fulfillment. Okay, like, fine, it's a young adult book, I don't expect it to be, you know, a great literature or anything, but I kind of wanted more than just that, and that sort of that limits it very much for me, I think. The
fair enough point.
I'll see the movie, I'm interested, I'll totally go
so
watch
real
it.
Quick before we get to the next question, the rest of Andrew's question, what are the next book or two on your reading list?
Oh yeah, I am currently finishing The Handmaid's Tale, which I started reading after I started watching the Hulu series, and is a really fascinating book. Have you read that book?
No, I think I was assigned to read it in English class in high school, but never actually read it.
It's really cool. I watched a few episodes of the show. Obviously, a terrifying show. And the book is similar and different at the same time. I decided to stop watching the show and read the book. But so far, I really like it. I don't want to weigh in on it until I've finished it. But Margaret Atwood is a fascinating writer. She really has this very distinct style. It's very inward-looking and very like personal and almost physical. It's very inside this narrator's body and herself, in a way that's really like claustrophobic, but also kind of it's a fascinating book. I really like it, so I'm reading that. And then I think next on my list, I'm not sure. Oh, I'm going to finish Six of Crows, I think, which I paused reading for a little bit, but I think I mentioned that before. That's a sort of fantasy heist, pretty breezy read.
Okay, cool. Next question.
Yes.
Joe says, hey, Kirk and Jason, I was just listening to your latest podcast and was wondering why you think there is more profit margin on a Switch versus SNES. The SNES probably costs almost nothing to build, given that you can make it for yourself for half the price with a Raspberry Pi, but a Switch must have cost them almost as much to make as they sell it for. So profit-wise, they are probably getting better returns on a classic console than a new one. I guess Switch games are where the difference comes in. Yeah, so Joe, it is, I mean, I don't know the exact profit margins on the Switch. I don't think that's public information. But the games are the huge difference. And also the fact that this is the future for Nintendo. Like, this is the next 5 years of their strategy for making money is not the Super Nintendo Classic. It is the Switch and building a giant install base of the Switch. And so it's not just the individual profits. Because the context of this is we were talking about why they would support the Switch over the SNES Classic.
Yeah.
And it's not just about individual machines' profits. It's also about the landscape of them bringing on third parties and getting licensing deals and just having this whole ecosystem of more and more people playing the Switch. The SNES Classic is just kind of a novelty item. It doesn't help them nearly as much.
Right. I mean, when you have shareholders, it's partly about establishing a framework for making money in the future. And the SNES Classic just doesn't really do that. It's a one-shot deal. You buy it, you get all the games on it, and you're done. Uh-huh. The Switch, you buy it, you're possibly going to buy 3-4 games a year, so that's that much money. You're going to download this many more. You're going to pay for the online service. That's like a subscription fee. Like, the Switch makes money in the future for Nintendo, and the SNES Classic does not.
Also, so I'm looking online, and so this is an estimate, so this is not official data at all, but there's an estimate, a Japanese site estimates that Nintendo spends about $257 per Switch, and so it sells for $300, so that would be a profit margin of 40-something, 43 bucks, something like that, if the estimate is even close to correct, which itself I think would be more than the SNES Classic, which will sell for 80 bucks. And then I don't know how much the materials would cost, but there's also licensing to Square and Capcom and all the other publishers that are involved there, so they can't be making that much more than 40 bucks a pop. So there you go.
Next one, I'll read this one. This is from Natapong, I guess. I hope I pronounced that right. Greetings from Thailand. I absolutely love your podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks. I haven't yet bought the Nintendo Switch, but I plan to in the future. Is there a chance that Nintendo will release a new Switch that doesn't have all the hardware issues people have complained about? I super, super, super want to play Breath of the Wild, but I'm not in a great hurry, so I want to wait for that perfect Switch. What do you think?
I think it's worth waiting at this point anyway, because I think they'll do some bundles in the fall for Black Friday. So if you're patient, just wait it out and get a I'm sure they'll have a $300 bundle with the Switch and Mario or something like that. I don't think they're gonna. At first, I thought they would do a new model pretty quickly, but based on the success of the Switch and just like the way they seem to fix the left Joy-Con issue pretty quickly. And are issuing replacements for anyone who wants to send theirs back in. I don't really think that hardware issues are that significant at this point.
Yeah, I think I agree, and I kind of think that it's interesting. It's played out a little bit differently than I thought, too. The fact that they fixed the Joy-Con is good. I'm sure that in a year or two, there will be some sort of a Switch Plus that has a camera or like built-in Bluetooth or something like that. Or like, I mean, you know, actual Bluetooth. I know there's Bluetooth on the controllers. But the whole collector's edition stuff is more playing out with the Joy-Con than I thought that it would. And actually, you can just, they're going to release new Joy-Con all the time that are, you know, there's Splatoon Joy-Con that are coming out. And then I'm sure in the fall, there will be some Mario ones or something.
There's
going to be
neon ones.
Yeah, like the neon ones that are out. So there's going to be, like, we're going to get that kind of thing. But the fact that if you buy a Switch now, the left Joy-Con issue, which was the main hardware, like real hardware problem that it launched with, has been fixed, makes me think, yeah. And then also the fact that there have never been enough Switches for people to buy. Like they've yet to be meeting demand. And that means I don't think they're in any way considering right now anyways buying a new Switch. So I would say, yeah, the same thing you said. Wait a couple months. There will be a Mario bundle or a Zelda bundle. Uh-huh. Then you'll save some money. Get that. But I think past that, you don't need to wait any longer.
Yeah, that's the advice I gave my brother also, who wants one. All right. Isaac says, Now, I've been burned over and over by Nintendo since 2012. I committed so hard to the Wii U and believed in the fact that they would make the next GameCube what all the fans wanted. Over and over, they burned me and most of their fans. I feel like someone who committed to a relationship with someone who emotionally unloads on me. And if I try to express my feelings to my partner, who is Nintendo, they go off and blow all their money on cocaine, which is our analogy for amiibos in this case, and then ask me to support them through this drug-addled and fruitless time.
I feel like
we
should bring in Harrison. We should bring in Dr. Nerdlove to answer this one.
Yeah. Suddenly the Switch comes out, and it's like they went to rehab and quit doing hard drugs, got out of depression, and started listening to me when I'm bummed out. But the thing is, I don't know if I can trust my partner anymore because they always say that they'll change. Over and over, they say it's going to be new, but over and over, they fail to give up the life, man. Can we trust that Nintendo is actually going to continue listening to us? They changed their eShop and subscription. They're coming out with Metroid. But how long until they relapse? How long?
First of all, Isaac, I want to say that if you're actually dealing with any of this stuff in a relationship, good luck to you. And it sounds like maybe you should get out of that relationship. So if this is all coming from a real experience, yeah, maybe bail on that.
But as for the question, that is a good question.
I think the thing is, Nintendo isn't a person. Like, the analogy holds, like, works. Like, I get how you're explaining the feeling of feeling burned and feeling like you want to trust them and feeling like each time you do, it's fine for a little while and then it isn't. And, like, relationships can be like that. But Nintendo is not a person because, like I said, if you were actually describing a relationship and your partner was Nintendo and doing the things Nintendo did, the easy advice would be like, no, get out. That's a toxic, shitty relationship. And like, this person right. probably isn't going to change and they need help. And you don't need to give them that help. But this is, we're not talking about a person. We're talking about Nintendo. And Nintendo, like people, companies can actually change in ways that people maybe don't.
But
so
analogies,
okay,
but the hyperbolic analogy aside, I think it's a good question. It's like, has Nintendo yes. listened to fans? Is Nintendo going to treat its customers differently this generation?
And that's a crucial question, right? Is Nintendo doing this stuff because they're listening to fans? And I am actually pretty skeptical about that.
Okay, so what makes you say that?
I think, like, when people said, oh, Nintendo listened, I think there's just this feeling of, and I think it's partly their remove, since they're in Japan and there's kind of a language barrier, but there's rarely, like, I really get a sense that Nintendo actually acknowledges that they're doing something because their fans said they wanted it. It's mm-hmm. more just, now we're doing this, and now we're doing this, and we're kind of left to guess at their motivations. So I'm not ready to give them the benefit of the doubt that because they, for example, changed the Switch's virtual console thing, like to a Netflix style, oh, you get to keep the game, you know, we don't take it away from you after a month, that ridiculous initial thing, that was necessarily because they were listening to fans. Like, it could have been a lot of things, reasons that they made that decision. So I am, to begin with, not even ready to say that Nintendo is listening to fans with the Switch. I think they just made some good decisions this time around.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. That's totally fair. And yeah, you're right in that they haven't been like, yep, we're listening to you this time.
Right.
Because Nintendo is rarely like that. They tend to always just be like, we're making these decisions and either accept them or don't.
Steven interviewed Reggie Fils-Aimé at E3, and he was asking about, he of course went in with all these questions that people want to know. And what he was like, have you heard everybody talking about, you know, how they want to back up their saves? Like, are we going to get to back up our saves on Switch games? And Reggie's answer was basically, I will say that we have heard that feedback or something. Like, it was very hands off. It wasn't even the usual, oh, like, we were always listening to our fans and trying to improve our product. And like, we're definitely have our ears out and we're aware of the feedback. It was just, it was very, very minimal. And I feel like that's always been Nintendo's approach to sort of acknowledging fan feedback. So I don't think that'll change, and they could very well start making stupid decisions again. I mean,
yeah, I think as someone who is a huge fan of Nintendo, I think that it's healthy to just assume the worst at all times.
Yeah. and then you won't be disappointed when something goes horribly wrong.
All right, you want to do the next one?
Yeah, next one. Okay. Hi, Kirk and Jason. This is from Brian. Hi, Kirk and Jason. Thank you guys for the awesome weekly podcast. I hope you guys are wrestling up after E3. Oh, this was after E3. In the light of publishers increasingly talking about games as a service, I was wondering whether there is any chance at all that there would be a significant decline in the number of single-player games developed in the future. I say this because looking at NPD numbers each month, most of the games are multiplayer-focused. I can definitely see from a business standpoint, it would behoove companies to focus more and more on multiplayer games in order to maximize profit. It also seems like the development of AAA single-player games is declining, with the exception of Sony for their PlayStation exclusives. I am a single-player gamer foremost and am slightly worried that these experiences might become rarer in the future. I would love to hear your thoughts. What do you think?
The answer is yes. They are declining and will continue to decline.
That's the short answer.
And it is very depressing for those of us who enjoy single-player games. Just look at Bethesda. They just put out this string of games like Dishonored 2 and Prey. And then come this fall, they're going to have Wolfenstein 2 and Evil Within 2, which are probably both going to flop, just like Prey and Dishonored 2 does.
I think there's a lot of buzz on Wolfenstein, but who knows?
I don't want to speculate about the future games.
Yeah, but I can look back at the past. I mean, you're not mentioning Doom, which I believe did very, very well and won a ton of awards and sold well.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't really know how well. Yeah. Well, first of all, that wasn't single player only. It has a multiplayer, even though multiplayer was
nobody
mediocre.
But we
don't know. Like, they made it out to seem like it was a big success.
Right.
But because Bethesda is a privately owned company and they don't reveal sales figures or financial at all, we don't know. And Prey and Dishonored 2 pretty clearly.
Okay, but also let me try and poke another hole in that about Bethesda. Bethesda's easily most successful games are massive single player games.
No, but let me make my point first before you try to poke holes in it.
I just want to poke all the holes in your
My point is that the one publisher that was actually willing to invest in all these single player only games, because even traditionally single player games like Mass Effect are getting multiplayer these days, that one publisher is not doing well with them as far as we can tell. So it seems like not only a risky investment, but a bad investment. I mean, as much as I love single-player games, especially RPGs, if I were in charge of a AAA gaming company and I had to make decisions that would with like multi-billion-dollar decisions on my head, I would be investing in Destiny-like service games because that's what makes the most money. I mean, period.
Yeah. So, of course, I agree. And I think that we're going to see a rise in games like that and probably fewer single-player games. But at the same time, I'm not ready to say that means we're not going to get single-player games or that they're a failure. I think there's going to be some middle ground. I mean,
saying they're dead.
Right. So, but I think that's important to underline. I mean, so many of the best games and really good selling games from this year are single player games. Resident Evil 7, pure single player game, sold really well. Nier Automata, I believe Square Enix said that game exceeded their sales expectations.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to probably get another Rise of the Tomb Raider, and like Tomb Raider has become this like big series that's for Square Enix to publish that's like single player. Really, single player only. I guess they added some multiplayer to one of them, but nobody cared.
Yeah, I think you just have to really be a special game these days. You can't just, you know, the games that, so like, for example, there's this game, Agents of Mayhem, coming in the summer, right? That's like a Saints Row-esque game, and it looks like one of those games that maybe a few years ago would be in the double A category of games that like just coast along and are mediocre and okay. And unless that game just blows people away and is incredible, that's going to flop because it's just in that middle ground of games where even games that are great like Dishonored 2, if they're not breaking new ground the way Nier did or the way Resident Evil 7 did, where they're just like revolutionary, like stellar, like the standards are so much higher, I think. And that's the biggest thing, is because these service games take up people's time to the point where if you are a League of Legends addict or a Destiny player, you are just going to play that by default unless someone is like to you, okay, this game is spectacular, you have to play it. And I don't think anyone is going to be like that except for the rare games like Horizon Zero Dawn and Nier Automata.
I also think that we're limiting this. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I think that we're limiting this a little bit by focusing on AAA, because the focus on AAA is ignoring the fact that indie games are increasingly fulfilling.
Well, that's what Brian's question was about AAA.
Right, I know, but I'm expanding the scope a little bit to say, since we're talking about like, are we going to get cool single player games again? Because there are games like, I don't know, there are going to be games like Divinity Original Sin or Pillars of Eternity 2, like from smaller studios with that don't need to be like, you know, the same kind of a world beating thing.
Yeah, of course. Stardew Valley.
So
Undertale.
It's like, right. Or what's the... Yeah, a lot. There are a lot of them. Oh, Invisible Ink, I was thinking of earlier.
Yeah.
And the Shadow Tactics, Blades of the Shogun. Like, there are so many of these games that are really meaty single-player games that have the production values of what would have been a AAA game, you know, 5 or 6 years ago even. It's just that, you know, if you have to look at the full spectrum, I guess, of games that you're going to get. There's actually going to be more cool single player games than ever. I mean, there seems like there were this year, and I think that won't stop. It's just right. There's going to be more and more of a focus on trying to become everybody's one main game instead of hoping to become the other game that they play when they have spare time.
Yeah, but it seems like, I mean, yeah, the choice for a AAA publisher is either you make a single-player game that really blows people away, the way Breath of the Wild did or Horizon Zero Dawn did, or you make a games as a service. The other big thing that we haven't talked about is that Nintendo, Sony, and to a lesser extent Microsoft, they can all get away with investing in single-player games just for the sake of selling consoles.
Right.
And that's what that's why Naughty Dog exists, to sell PlayStations. Because Uncharted 4 and The Last of Us 2 and those games are such big investments that I don't think they would be able to stick around if not for the fact that they help Sony move hardware, and Sony makes a lot of money off of their hardware.
Right.
So Horizon, and I'm sure we'll see a sequel to Horizon for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Similar to what we were talking about with the earlier question about release dates, like,
yeah.
I think we'll see companies like Activision, certainly Blizzard is already doing this, EA move more away from single player only games and more toward games as a service.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question.
Mark
says.
Wait, did I read the last one? So you're reading
you
this
sure
one?
Did. Mark says, I've recently been reflecting on some of my favorite games, and it occurred to me that Horizon Zero Dawn is some of the best opening hours of any game I've ever played. I loved watching Aloy grow up and learn about the community who had shunned her. Then it dawned on me, I finally have a question worthy of your podcast. Which game has your favorite opening hours? Whether it's a game that has a strong narrative opening or a tutorial done right. I'd love to hear both of your thoughts.
Oh man, that's a great question, Mark.
P.S. The weather here in Maryland is extremely humid and kind of sucks.
Oh, that's too bad. It's been really hot in Portland, too. How's the weather been in New York?
Today, it's rainy. Today, actually, funny story. I noticed that I use the weather app on my phone before I leave the apartment to check what it's like out. And it's always wrong. Today, it was just like cloudy. And then I walk outside and it's pouring rain.
Huh.
So that's funny. Very annoying. I wish we had more accurate forecasting.
Well, it's funny because I lived in San Francisco for a long time, and the weather apps are always wrong in San Francisco just because there's like 1,000 microclimates in that town. But in Portland, the weather is much more consistent. And I've actually really enjoyed being able to look at like the iPhone weather app and know, okay, this is actually what the weather is going to be when I step outside. So it's been pretty consistent
that is
up here.
Okay, what are your favorite video game opening hours?
Man, I have so many. I love the beginnings of games. I've always loved the beginnings of games. I love tutorials. I love playing through. I love when the game is introducing itself to you. It's a similar reason that I love TV pilots. I know some people don't like TV pilots, but I love TV pilots because I love when everything is new and they're so excited to show you what's new.
So what are your favorites?
One of my favorites is Mass Effect 2. I think the beginning of Mass Effect 2 is really, really, really good. Just that whole sequence where you die and you're reborn, and just the like flying out into space, the way the title comes up as you hear Shepard's breathing, she just slowly stops breathing and she like burns up. I love that intro. And then just the whole, you know, even past that, like into the when you first meet the elusive man and and all of that, and you get to what's it called, Omega, for the first time, and it's just the whole vibe of that entire beginning. So that's one of mine. What's one of yours?
I don't know. I mean, there are tons. After we record this podcast, I'm going to think of the perfect answer. Final Fantasy VII comes to mind.
Yeah, that would be one I would say too.
Because being in Midgar and then it opening up and just blowing your mind for the first time after you leave Midgar and you realize that, no, wait a minute, there's an entire world map and you just spent the past 4 hours in this tiny little city. Just the feeling of exiting and then seeing that where you spent all of that time is just like a little icon on the world map is pretty mind-boggling.
I feel like that sort of a feeling, I think I wrote about this way back on my blog a million years ago, my little personal blog. The feeling of like when the world first opens, I think it's something that Bethesda game studios are amazing at, like, especially, I guess it's actually probably in Oblivion. The Elder Scrolls Oblivion was the one that I really remember because you always come out of a dungeon
in
those games.
Yeah,
you're always in a dungeon or something.
And I was going to say Prey is actually a really good intro.
Yeah, it is really good, isn't it?
Of games that I've played recently. And yeah, Horizons is really cool. The transition of her moving from kid to adult, that little montage.
I liked that
really
cutscene.
Cool.
I actually thought that the kid version of her was sort of weird looking and was not totally into that. I thought there was stuff in the very beginning of Horizons intro that I didn't love. Like when you have to listen to some audio logs, it's one of the first things you do in the game is you get dropped into this bunker underground and then suddenly you're listening to audio logs. And I was like, fucking seriously? I haven't even learned how to like jump yet. And I'm listening to some person talk on an audio log. So that sort of bummed me out. But then I did like that cutscene where she's running and then she jumps through the air and then suddenly she like lands and she's, you know, grown up and she looks back at him. I thought that was... That was some good dad. It was some good dad stuff.
One of my least favorite intros is actually my favorite video game of all time, Suikoden 2, which happens to have a really slow intro that kind of turns people off when they first play it, but it justifies itself at the end.
Yeah, I think that would be a whole other list, but there are definitely games that start they're not super common, but there are games that start weak and then get better the more you play them. So that's true too.
All right, next question.
Next one. Do I read this one? I'm still lost.
How do you have trouble remembering this?
I don't know.
Yes, I just read the last one, so it's your
turn. Very in the moment here. I'm in the moment. Okay, so this one is from Ben. Ben writes, recently started listening to the show and have become a big fan. As such, I have been flip-flopping between listening to the current stuff and catching up from the beginning. Listening to you guys talk about predictions and what you think of the future in early episodes is fascinating, especially with my unique perspective of seeing these predictions start to take shape in the present. This led me to wondering, what do you guys think the video game landscape will look like in 5 years? Will consoles still be viable? Will games as a service... Will that lead to less AAA releases and more extended episodic-style content? I understand this is a very loaded and widespread question, but considering that both of you are connected to the industry, I would be interested to hear what you really flesh out your thoughts on this. Thanks so much for your time, and I've been enjoying your E3 coverage. Okay, Ben, yeah, that is a big question. Probably bigger than we have time to answer right now, but we can give it a shot.
Yeah, man, that's interesting. I don't know, because it's hard to tell what the hardware will look like. For example, if you went 5 years ago, and this is an interesting thought exercise, 5 years ago, July 2012, pundits were saying the iPad is the future. Facebook gaming is the future. Yep. Kotaku almost launched a social and mobile website that was just dedicated to Facebook and mobile games. Everybody thought that the industry was moving that way. And then the PS4 and Xbox One come out a year later and the PS4 just sells monstrously. And everyone's like, oh, wait a minute, people are still interested in console games. So I think hardware plays such a big role in that. The big question is VR, whether that's going to crash or whether it'll become this giant sprawling entity in 5 years. Games as a service, I think, will still be a big thing. What do you think?
Yeah, I think... I think that we're still riding some of the sort of seismic waves from the launch of the PS4 and the Xbox One and how unexpectedly successful those were, to the point where I think that what it seems like they took away from it, the people who make these consoles, was, oh shit, we didn't have to wait, you know, 7 years to launch another console. We can launch another console a couple years and there's a audience of people that'll just buy a new console. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now with these sort of iterative, you know, the PlayStation 4 Pro and the Xbox One X. So I think a lot of where we'll be in 5 years will depend on what they take away from how those two consoles do,
right,
and whether they decide to keep going down that path. I'm not ready to make a prediction one way or another. I think they haven't really nailed it yet. Like they haven't, at least these first iterations, like the Pro and the Xbox One X aren't super convincing to me. So, and I don't know how they're selling, you know, Sony says what it's like 1 in 5 PS4s sold as a PS4 Pro. And that they say that's good, but I have no idea if that's actually good, if they're just saying that. So in 5 years, I think it'll really depend. If this turns out to be a success, then yeah, we'll probably be getting like more iterative console updates and game consoles will still be a thing. If it doesn't, who knows?
So something I was thinking about is that even though it's been almost 4 years since the PS4 and Xbox One came out, it still feels like we're early in this generation.
I think it feels like we're in the middle of it. I think it
you
feels
think so? For
about...
me, it feels so early still.
Well, so one of the things is that I am just thinking of right now, so this is a thought I'm having, so I haven't fully fleshed it out, but it's that the timeline for making a video game is like two to four years, right? And as a result, if you're kind of changing the hardware faster than that, you're not going to see that same sort of like software maturation that we saw over the sort of 7 years of that last generation. So there was this feeling with the PS3, Xbox 360 generation, where toward the end of the generation, like toward the end of those consoles' lifespans, we started seeing really incredible games. Like that was when, you know, The Last of Us came out, and Uncharted even was sort of like toward the back half of that, and sort of the really big, impressive stuff started coming out toward the end. And you really got the sense that all the developers really had their head around like how to max out these consoles and get the most out of them, and then they could focus on, you know, making really good games instead. If we don't have that much time for the hardware to just sit still, and people, if it's always kind of a moving target, I wonder if that will make it just feel different. Because it feels to me like we're in the middle right now. It feels like people have gotten pretty comfortable with these consoles, but we still haven't quite seen
that many of those. Well, so the point I was going to make before is that because it feels to me like it's still early, you say middle, but to me it still feels early just because of the way that the first year of the PS4, there were so few games on it that it felt like a wash anyway. So really the console started in like late 2014 is when games really started coming out. Right? But anyway, because of that, it feels like if Sony were to announce a PlayStation 5 in 1 or 2 years, I feel like it would almost have to play PS4 games because people are so invested in this generation. Yeah. But so that raises a question, what would a PS5 actually look like? Would it really be that huge a hardware leap? And our graphics, I mean, video games graphics have gotten to the point where they just look so tremendous and the baseline is just so spectacular that it doesn't really feel like we need to buy another piece of hardware anytime soon. And that's why the console makers are focusing on 4K TVs as opposed to what the game can actually do and the number of polygons and the graphical fidelity of the game itself, because it's now just about the TV rather than what the game can do.
I think it's also about memory ceilings and like how much processing you can be doing at once, right? And that is like a change that we're continually seeing in ways that we don't always appreciate or notice, right? Like, I mean, there is the fact that with so much more RAM, and then if they double it again and double it again for a new console, there are things that are just, you can do a bajillion more animations and you can have characters that move and react in a jillion different ways.
Sure, and then you have to, and then budgets will
quadruple
accordingly.
Of course.
I don't know, at some point it hits this point of diminishing returns and all that stuff.
That may be true, but I don't think we've ever seen, at least in terms of whatever the thing, we talked about it quite a while ago, about the idea that like computation is always getting faster.
What's the law?
Yeah, I don't know.
Moore's law, is that it?
Maybe. But that idea, I feel like there's no, we've never really gotten a sign that that's going to stop happening, or that, you know, that there isn't always going to be some new target. Like once it's not 4K, it's going to be at a higher resolution. And
it is Moore's law, by the way.
Okay, Moore's law.
But to the point that I was trying to make earlier is also that this generation just feels like it still has so much to do. It feels like there's so much like that game developers could put into this. Like to me, at least, obviously I don't make video games, and maybe people who do make games feel a little bit differently, but it doesn't feel like we're being constrained at all by hardware the way we were towards the end of the PS3 and 360 eras, where it really felt like the PC had just like jumped ahead of everybody else. I don't know. It feels like it would be a waste for us to move to another hardware generation anytime soon, when I feel like there's still so much more we could get out of it.
Right. And I think it, like I was saying before, I don't really think that's necessarily going to happen. Like I think a lot of it depends on how this mid upgrade goes. And it could be that we just don't, like they just keep doing that. And, you know, it doesn't become this like, oh, now we have a whole new console to develop for, and there's going to be games on that aren't on other systems. Like it's going to work a little more like phones.
I think Microsoft's approach is that. And I think Sony has said that they plan to do more of a traditional PS5.
Yeah, they've said that, but I think it all
also Microsoft. I mean, for all who knows about Microsoft, like I can't see them ever doing. I mean, I'm sure they will do another Xbox One X style upgrade, but I don't think they'll ever really make another Xbox, proper Xbox, like new generation of Xbox, unless they somehow get back into the race and turn their fortunes around, but I don't see them doing that because they're still supporting PC with all their games. I don't see the point.
Then the question of virtual reality, I think, is less of a big question. I don't think it's like the big question hanging over this is whether or not VR is going to be successful. I think that, like, I don't know, over 5 years, I don't know how long any of this stuff takes. But like VR is still, and AR and, you know, the HoloLens and the Oculus Rift and the Vive and all of these companies that are still kind of doing just R&D and figuring out how to make this stuff. Like, I don't know that in 5 years we're going to be that much farther toward the sort of, you know, Ready Player One, everybody has a VR system in their house and is using it all the time to do the like Facebook chat that they show at Oculus. Like, I just don't know if that's ever going to be the way that people use this stuff, but I do think that that technology will just be more prevalent and more commonly used for things. I really don't know what a VR industry might look like by then, if anything.
If
there even is one.
All right, so we probably have time for one or two more questions.
Sounds good.
So John sent in a note. I just included this here. It's not a question, but he's basically saying that he was offering another opinion and saying that he bought a new 4K TV and he was skeptical, but he loves it. Even the movies that are rerun, like E.T., just look incredible. He says, I don't know what wizardry they use, but me likey. He says, Breath of the Wild upscaled on his 4K TV looks incredible too. So we got a couple of notes from people. Someone else named Forrest also said he bought a big 4K TV and he plans on buying the Xbox One X just for that and that.
Yeah, you know, we did a poll a few weeks ago asking, do you have a 4K TV? After we had talked about that, I think when you and I were reacting to the Xbox One X.
Oh, yeah. Initially, what were the final numbers on that?
Final numbers were more or less like, is about 2/3 to 1/3. It was a few more than that did not have 4K. So it was like maybe like 60% to 40%, like 60-40-ish. Mm-hmm. That was 60% did not have 4K TVs and 40% did. And of the people who
didn't... That's higher than I expected.
Yeah, it was higher than I expected. And of the people who didn't, the majority at least said they weren't really planning on getting one. And gotcha. I think what I came away with talking to a lot of people, this is an interesting thing I've just been sort of asking people lately, is most people feel similarly to how I feel, which is basically at some point, if you just get a TV, it's going to be a 4K TV. Like, it'll just be like 1080p is now or whatever. Like, there won't be...
Right, it just becomes the standard.
Yeah, and so like, I've had the same TV for a long time and I still think it's fine. And then at some point I'll get a new one and it'll be like, you know, a 4K smart TV with like Alexa built into it and all this other shit that I didn't go out to get. It just will be, okay, well, that one's on sale and that sounds cool. And then, you know, and that'll just be my TV. And then I'm sure like I totally believe people who say... Yeah, I set it up and it's actually pretty amazing looking. So, you know, I'm looking forward to that, but still I'm not going to go out and actively buy one.
Okay, let's do one last question.
Okay.
I'll read this one. It's from Tom. Tom says, very intrigued by the Anthem announcement footage and immediately I had a question for you both. Do you have any intel or general thoughts given your experience with Destiny on whether this game could truly be played as a single player? I'm almost ashamed to say I'm woefully ignorant on Destiny, so curious for your input on if these games can truly be played alone for those of us who don't have a horde of friends who may be doing the same and on the same platform to join in. So first of all, Tom, yes, we do have a lot of experience in Destiny. You came to the right people. So we don't actually know everything about Anthem. It's still very far away. It's coming fall of 2018. I don't think they've said whether it's an online-only game or whether you'll be able to play it offline. I think it's safe to assume that it is online-only, given the focus and the multiplayer focus. Destiny, you can totally play by yourself and have a great time playing through all of the missions and story. And if you want to play online just by yourself, you can play PvP on your own. The only thing you can't do is raids, but even playing those with strangers can be fun. So if Anthem is similar and it's approached in a similar way to Destiny, I'm sure that it'll be just as cool to play by yourself.
I hope that it's fun to play by yourself. This is a BioWare game, and one of my favorite things about BioWare games are party members and banter. And I hope that not only is this a game you can play by yourself like Destiny, where, you know, you play through the mission and it's just you instead of you and three friends or two friends. And like, it gets a lot harder in Destiny if you play the harder stuff, because if you die, you immediately wipe back to a checkpoint instead of, you know, you basically get as many extra lives as you have people with you, and you can use that in so many ways to get through stuff faster. So I hope it isn't the exact same as Destiny. Like, I hope that in my hope, my dream, I know this is not based on anything, would be that they would do something where if you're not playing with your friends, there are party members who you can take out with you, and those party members are characters in the game that are written, you know, BioWare style, and they banter with each other out in the field, and they do that, and then they're like AI controlled fighters that fight alongside.
But then you would be missing out on the on those if you played.
Well,
with your
I think that depends though on the game. Like, it depends on whether we're talking about a game that is like a BioWare style narrative game with like story missions, which I'm assuming there will be. But also, if you're just going out and doing, you know, exploring open world, repetitive, like, or even some procedurally generated stuff, you could do that with your friends or just with, you know, an AI controlled teammate.
Yeah, I guess it depends. I was just thinking about Baldur's Gate, because all of those Infinity Engine style games, you could play multiplayer, even though not a lot of people knew about that. And so you could either play by yourself and open a multiplayer mode and then customize your party of six, or you could play with other people online together. And then, so if you did that, you would miss out on having the companions with you, because you would have a party full of customized characters, and you would miss out on a huge chunk of the game because you wouldn't get banter or dialogue with them or their side quests or anything like that. So I don't know. It feels like if it's done that way, there will be a right way and a wrong way to play.
Yeah, and I mean, off the top of my head, I can think of ways that, like, if you're doing a story mission, you can only play with one other person. And like, if it's like a main story mission, someone like an NPC always comes with, because like they're supposed to, or you have, you know, you get a 4-person party and 2 of them are NPCs for certain missions. But then for other missions, you can do it with anybody. And then the raid, you never do with anybody. So you have to, I don't know, whatever. Like, there's a lot of ways they could get around that.
Yeah.
And given that they're the same studio that made a lot of this stuff, I would assume, or at least hope, that they're coming up with creative solutions and new ideas to try with that. So that's my hope.
We know so little about this game that it's really just a ton of speculation.
Oh, yes.
At this
it's
point.
Entirely speculation, but we can dream.
Just based on the fact that it seems like a Destiny-ish game.
Yes.
All right. I think that's it for this week.
Yeah, that was a lot of letters. Thanks, everybody, for writing in.
Yes. And remember, you can reach us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.
Yeah. All right, time to go do this thing. Jason, it was nice to talk to you as always.
All right, farewell, Kirk.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR Now, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. And we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.